This is the Education Gadfly Show.
We've been talking about our seasonal affective disorder going on here in D.C. It is the darkest time of the year, and it is depressing out there.
There's a reason that seasonal affective disorder spells S-A-D.
Now, here's your host, Mike Petrilli.
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me in welcoming my co-host, the Vitamin D of Education Policy, Dara Z. Handler.
Thank you. Trying to make your winter a little more bearable.
That is exactly right. We've been talking about our seasonal affective disorder going on here in D.C. And of course, it's not as bad, certainly, as our friends that live further north. But still, it is the darkest time of the year, and it is depressing out there.
There is a reason that seasonal affective disorder spells S-A-D. It makes me sad.
But the vitamin D thing, this seems like good science out there on jamming the vitamin D. It really does seem to help. So we're all over that. Okay. Because you know what, Dara, we try to bring our listeners not just the latest research in education policy, but also things that they can use in their real life.
It's good for them.
Yeah, that's good for them. Because we all know that education policy, you can use that in your real life too. It's just that there's not a direct connection between education policy and your own life all that often, as I discovered by writing my book, The Diverse Schools Dilemma. I just want to get a plug in there for it. Okay, lots to cover this week. Let's get started by playing Pardon the Gadfly.
Checker has a piece in this week's Gadfly on bringing MOOCs to K-12 education. Is this a good idea?
So first of all, let's discuss MOOC, Massive Open Online Course, right? This is taking higher ed by storm. These are courses that people can take from elite colleges, generally not for credit, is my understanding, but you can learn from the world's great professors and do it for free. Checker's saying, hey, why not do this in K-12, have Exeter and other elite schools provide these courses, and maybe figure out a way to do it for credit. Is this a good idea?
I would say hesitantly, maybe. The problem is when you get a course that is not for credit, it still can be for something else. So maybe you don't get the grade as counted in your GPA, but it might count as seat time. It might count as for your overall credit hours. It counts for something, especially if you're talking about, you know, why would people take these classes to begin with? Your average college student, I like to think that they want to learn, but most of the time they want to get something out of it.
So look, the idea of a credit hour, the Carnegie unit, whatever you want to call it, this seems to be teetering on the edge of extinction here, right? I mean, this has been the system for a long time. It's based on this seat time notion, both in high schools as well as in colleges. And yet now we've got all these courses online. And the question is, why not just move to a whole new paradigm where you just say, hey, if you can demonstrate that you know this stuff, you can pass the test, then you can get whatever you need to work towards your diploma. I mean, why not just move away from this idea of credit hours completely?
I think the problem is, well, who writes the test? If the test is being administered at your home institution where they have a check on the quality of the course that you took somewhere else, I see a reason for it. But a lot of the problem when you're looking at higher ed right now is students are taking these online courses at other institutions, and those institutions are the ones testing them, and all they come back with is, look, I got an A, and their home institution has no idea what they actually learned.
And you're saying that there is not necessarily incentives for these institutions to have high standards, that the game is, hey, you pay your money, we will give you your credit hour. It's a diploma mill. We see this in high schools with credit recovery programs. These online credit recovery programs, where all the incentives are for to get those kids their credits, even if they don't know a whole lot or aren't spending much time in this coursework.
Exactly. And I think one way of mitigating this is to put the test at the home institution. Then you find out, well, what are you really getting? But again, it's difficult for these providers when at this point their incentive is profit.
Mm-hmm. So I think, look, what we need here are external exams of some sort. But and if you get to the point where you say, look, we will give you some sort of credit, or at the high school level, we'll allow you to graduate. At the college level, we can work towards, you know, a diploma if you know your stuff. But let's be clear that this is a whole new paradigm, and there's a lot of kids out there who could learn a whole lot of things without stepping foot in a classroom, right? Including with that age-old technology called a book. And I think the question is, can we get comfortable with that notion that as long as people can demonstrate that they know something or able to do something, we will give them a badge, we'll give them credit, we'll give them whatever you want to call it so that they can get on to their next phase in life. Okay, topic number two.
The fiscal cliff still looms. If Congress and the administration fail to come to a deal, there will be across-the-board cuts. What could happen to education?
Well, so first of all, Dara, you know, the key thing to know here is that federal government only pays 10% of the bills, right? So even if there's a hefty cut at the federal level, by the time you take it's, you know, let's say 20% cut at the federal level. Well, it's 20% of the 10%, right? So that's more like a 2% cut for most local school districts, maybe a little bit more for some districts that rely more on the federal funding. So is this really a whole lot of fuss about not much? What do you think?
Well, I would agree that to the extent that you explained it so far, and I know that there's more coming, that no, it's not too much of a fuss, but then you get into the problem of indirect fallout for K-12 education, where it's not, if we go off the cliff, it's not just cuts to K-12 education that are happening, it's cuts to other programs that states pay for, like Medicare, Medicaid, things like that, and the feds only pay 10% of education, but the state pays for about 50%. Mm-hmm. So if the state is getting cut elsewhere, the big question, and we don't know, is if they're getting cut, are they going to shift money away from K-12 education in order to make up for the loss of federal funds in these other areas? And that is the huge question mark.
That's a great question. Of course, Medicaid is a big one there, you know, the big healthcare program for the poor. And if the feds cut that program, the states are probably going to have to come up with the money for it. Now, you know, on we're talking about the cut side. On the revenue side, a lot of discussion out there about what kind of taxes could be raised to try to avoid the fiscal cliff. Of course, tax rates has been a big debate, but also closing so-called loopholes and deductions. Some of these can hit education big as well. A lot interest on the Republican side, for example, taking away the deduction that people get for their state and local income taxes and other kinds of taxes, property taxes. And the problem for education, the idea is that it suddenly if you take away or you create an incentive for states or local districts to lower their taxes because people can't deduct them from their federal taxes, they might cut spending further.
Again, I hate to not give a concrete answer, but it's going to depend. It's going to depend a lot on what the state law is about where the property taxes go. And does a district with higher property taxes get to keep that money? Does the state provide equalization funds for a district that has lower property taxes and maybe a wealthier district lowers their property taxes, knowing that the state is going to backfill in the difference? It depends, and it's a scary thing not to know.
The other issue out here is that you've got the education groups, very strangely in my view, and Rick Hess's as well, he wrote a blog post about this, teaming up with many of the other liberal progressive groups saying, don't cut Medicare, don't cut Social Security, protect these entitlement programs. Even though, in my view, and in this right, there's a huge, look, we have all these baby boomers retiring. There's a lot of evidence that we're going to spend all this money on old people. Shouldn't the education groups say, hey, we can't spend all this money on old people if we want to spend the money on our young people? Yet they're out there saying, what, we're going to spend money on the old and the young? Where's this money coming from?
I think the idea is you just, in this time of uncertainty, when you don't know if they're going to cut or fund for the old people, if the fallout is going to hit K-12 education, if the fallout is going to hit someone else, they just don't know. So they figure no cut is better than nothing.
I think I've said it before, Dara, maybe not on the air. See, this is how you solve entitlements, okay? People reach the average life expectancy and they're done. They're done. Medicare, you're done. Social Security, you're done. That solves all of our problems. We can afford to fund the young. Okay, topic number three. I'm mostly kidding with that, people, but not entirely. Okay, topic three.
Lansing policymakers will decide today whether Michigan will become a right-to-work state. What does that mean?
This is a good question because a lot of people think that this is about whether or not people can collectively bargain, but not so, right, Dara?
That is correct. Collective bargaining rights and right to work are not the same thing.
Boom.
So what right to work means is that you do not have to be as a teacher. You do not have to belong to your union in order to work in a unionized industry. For example, education. It means that if Michigan were to become right to work, a teacher in a Michigan district could say, I don't want to become a member of the union, and they don't have to be. And more than that, the union is not allowed to say, well, you might not want to be a member, but give us some money anyway because we're helping you out. So they're not allowed to collect agency fees from them.
Right.
However, it does not mean that those teachers in that Michigan district cannot bargain collectively. They still can.
Right. So collective bargaining will go on in Michigan, but the agency fees would go away. Does this matter? You and Amber and Janie just did a huge study of teacher unions around the country. What did we find about those agency fees? Are they important?
Agency fees are critically important because unions, especially the state level union, as these advocacy lobbying organizations, well, what do they use the agency fees for? That's what they use it for, these political activities. So it is a big deal. There's a precedent here too. Indiana became the first Rust Belt state to become a right to work state. And now we see that at least the ball started rolling on education reform there. Maybe not so successful in the last election, but it did start the ball rolling.
Right. No, we got Indiana. We've got Wisconsin, of course. Almost happened in Ohio, but then they brought it back with the referendum. Now it looks like it's going to happen in Michigan. Okay, that is all the time we've got. Thank you, Pamela. That was Pamela, who was helping us there with Pardon the Gadfly and producing the show at the same time. Amazing. Dara, well played. It is now time for everyone's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Welcome back to the show, Amber.
Thank you, Mike.
Amber, how do you stay so chipper in these dark winter days?
Chipper? Lots of candy that my friend over here, Dara, makes for me. Cookies, candy, sweets. Sugar will get you by on a cloudy day any day.
That helps you. Nice. Vitamin D? Do you rock the vitamin D?
No, just sugar.
No. A light box? Have you ever tried one of those light boxes?
Never even heard of it, Mike.
Yeah. No, they've got these things you can plug in. They create, it's sort of like artificial sunlight.
Oh, I got you. Light box. Get it?
Yeah. Yeah.
Don't have it.
All right, well. It gets especially dark back there in the Fordham research catacomb late in the afternoon now.
That's why I bring cookies.
Right. Okay, what you got for us this week, Amber?
Oh, 2011 results from the latest set of international reading, math, and science tests. Whew, lots of information here. So just a reminder, PEARLS is administered in grade 4, and math and science, TIMS, administered in grades 4 and 8. News is mostly encouraging for U.S. youngsters this time around. Lots of progress since the last administration of the tests in 2006-07, though there's still lots of work to be done. 53 systems participate in the PEARLS, roughly 57 in TIMS at both grades. Large enough samples in 9 states also participate in either TIMS or PEARLS to render their own results. So here's some highlights. I've got a lot, but we'll just do a few. The average score of U.S. fourth graders was higher than the PEARLS scale average, which is set at 500. Of the 50 systems participating, 5 had higher averages than the U.S., including Hong Kong, the Russian Federation, Finland, Singapore, and the state of Florida.
This is in reading.
Ooh, in reading, yes. Right. PEARLS is reading. Yep. 40 had lower scores and 7 had scores not statistically different from ours. Higher percentages of fourth graders reached advanced status in reading than the international median. 17% of our fourth graders reached advanced status. Singapore and Florida had higher percentages. A little bit about, let's do average fourth grade math, okay? Mm-hmm. Rose 12 points between 2007 and 11. We were one of 12 systems with an increase. In eighth grade, nearly half of all students tested in South Korea, Singapore, and Chinese Taipei reached the advanced level in math, compared to just 7% of our kids. A little bit about the states, and then I'll close it off. Florida's average math score in grade 4 math was higher than the average in 43 systems, but not different from the U.S. average. North Carolina's average score was higher than the average in 47 systems, including the U.S. In grade 8 math, Massachusetts, Indiana, and North Carolina, among others, bested the TIMS average and the U.S. national average. California was below the U.S. average, as was Alabama. In science, we pretty much stayed the same in both grades since the last time.
Whew. Well, a lot to unpack here. Okay, so let's start with the reading. Okay, mm-hmm. The way I read it, incredibly encouraging. Big jump in reading scores for American kids, mm-hmm. right? That started in 2006, 2007,
right?
All right,
they were
right,
in yeah. different years.
Yeah, yeah. Which would have been around the time that Reading First would have been mm-hmm. really implement. You know, that the kids who first got Reading First would have been reaching the fourth grade. if I do my math right. Okay, right. So what do you think? Do we give some credit to the Reading First program for this?
I mean, I want to do that because, you know, I evaluated Reading First when I was at WestStat years ago, and really, I mean, and like actually looked at fidelity of implementation, at least in a couple states, and those teachers were implementing. They had those five, you know, phonemic awareness. It was something easy they could latch on to and teach. It wasn't this sort of fuzzy stuff to be implemented. It was very concrete. So I don't know. I think it had to have something to do with it.
All right, and good progress in math as well. So kind of even Steven in science?
In science. Did I skip science? What happened in science? Little increases in science. That's right. U.S. was above the TIMS scale average in both grades. So respectable.
All right. So this all sounds like pretty good news. And yet most of the press, the headlines this week were the typical negative headlines. American students trail international competitors headlines.
It's the Asian Tigers. You know, they're still ahead of us. And I guess that gets to us. So there's still that.
I mean, what's your take, though? I mean, is this... I know for a long time the defenders of the traditional system, let's say, were always been upset with the way these test scores get reported. Now, you know, reformers might want to say, hey, we want to show that we're making progress. We're seeing progress here. Good things are happening in the era of reform. And yet the press is coming out with these negative headlines. I mean, what gives?
Well, I mean, does good news make news? We know sometimes it doesn't. But the other thing I didn't have time to mention was Finland. Mm-hmm. Did you guys see this? So we scored, let me make sure I get it right. Eighth grade scores were about the same as those in the United States. Several U.S. states, Massachusetts and Minnesota, posted higher scores than Finland.
We caught up to Finland in math, right? And Finland's math scores dropped. I love it. All those people, you know, they spent all that money flying to Finland.
Right.
Yeah. Now where are they going to go? They might want to go to Massachusetts.
Yeah, right. Oh, boy. But, I mean, you know, we only have nine states. I mean, when I'm reading this, I'm thinking, wow, I wish every state could participate, right? Because it really makes you curious about that.
But let me ask you that, and you too, Dara. It seems like all of the state results on these TIMS is exactly what you'd predict. You could just look at the NAEP and you'd say, okay, of course Massachusetts is going to do better than Florida. Right. You know that from the NAEP. I mean, are we learning anything new?
Yeah, in Alabama,
it seems like a lot of money to learn the same thing you can learn by just making a few little computations based on the name, right?
Yeah, well, but you don't have... I mean, I guess, who is that? Gary Phillips that's done those international comparisons using our NAEP. And yeah, maybe. I don't know. I just get a little nervous when we start using sort of NAEP in different ways. Even though they've got these great ways to calculate and do the standardized scores and all that, I still get a little nervous when we make those comparisons.
Agreed. We might not be, with this analysis, we might not be learning anything new about the students in those states, but we are learning something new about the tests that we use in order to make those comparisons. And if the states ended up falling where we expected in this international comparison, then we can turn around and say, well, perhaps that our own national tests are measuring in a way that we expect as well.
I mean, the other thing that was brought up, which was a good point, was that TIMS includes some of these less industrialized nations where PISA is really OECD. Yeah. So we've got some of those, you know, less industrialized nations in that average. So that makes a difference, too, in terms of the participating systems.
Very good. All right. Thanks, everybody. That is all the time we have for this week. We will be back next week with one last show before the holidays. And until then,
I'm Dara Z. Handelar.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute's Education Gadfly Show. Signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.